Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In late July, disagreements over farm subsidies led to the collapse of international talks aimed at lowering trade barriers. This so-called Doha round began in 2001, and in the years since, it seems very little progress towards agreement have been made. And there is no word yet of when or even if these talks will resume. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the World Trade Organization and about some of the key issues in these long-running negotiations. And our guest for the program is David Ordon. He is a senior research fellow in the Markets, Trade, and Institutions Division at the International Food Policy Research Institute. It's based in Washington, D.C. He's also professor of agricultural and applied economics at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University, and does research and public policy education on the economics and the political economy of domestic support policies, of international trade negotiations, and technical barriers to trade. He's the author of a couple of books, one titled Policy Reform in American Agriculture, that got an award for the quality of agricultural communication here from the American Ag Economics Association back in 2000, and also is author of a book, Food Regulation and Trade Toward a Safe and Open Global System, that was published in March of 2004. He has a PhD in economics from University of Minnesota, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions and comments are welcome. Please, however, callers, please be brief. You're sharing the space with other people. We only have so much time. We like to get in as many people as we possibly can and keep the program moving along. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number and calls on us. That's 800-222-9455 and locally 333-9455. At any point here, you're welcome to call and join the conversation. Professor Ordon, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on the program.
You know, I think it really, we need to start here talking at a fairly basic level. I'm sure that people who follow issues of international trade are familiar with what we're talking about. And certainly people, I'm sure there'll be people listening to us this morning who are involved one way or another in agriculture, and they have been following this. But I think that probably for a lot of other people, this is just a great mystery about what exactly all of this is about. Now, this current, as I say, this current round of talks, this has been going on now for years. It started in November of 2001. And the first meeting was in Qatar, in Doha. So that's why it's called the Doha Round. But periodically there have been other meetings in other places, in Cancun, in Geneva, in Paris, in Hong Kong. So every once in a while, the representatives of the interested parties get together and talk. And now the last one, the one that just happened in July, where things were officially declared at being at an impasse, what really are these talks about? What's the object of these meetings?
Okay, well, the object of the meetings is to reduce barriers to trade and facilitate the globalization of the world economy, which is really taking place even with the current trade barriers in place. Ever since World War II, there have been a number of rounds of trade negotiations like the round that we're in now. They used to have names for people. There was the Kennedy round, which is very famous because it led to a large cut in industrial tariffs. But then they switched to changing the name to have the name be like the Uruguay round in the 1980s up till the mid-1990s, this one, the Doha round. The name comes from the city where the meeting is first launched, and then most of the negotiations take place in Geneva. Every 2 years, there's a ministerial meeting, like the ones you mentioned in Qatar, in Cancun in 2003, and in Hong Kong in December 2005. That's where the trade ministers, you know, our U.S. trade representative, for example, would be at the meetings. In principle, the highest level decisions are meant to be made there. The round was launched in 2001. That was, of course, right after the September 11th bombings, and so there was a sort of an energy to say we need to try to keep the world integrated, in much the same way as trade policy was viewed as an important political and economic instrument when there was sort of a communist regime versus Western world battle for dominance going on. So the round was launched. It was launched particularly with a focus on we need to bring the poorer countries, the developing countries, more fully into the global trade regime. That's the idea.
And it seems now that here, if you take a look at what are the major interests here, they seem to be the interests that are represented by, on the one hand, the developed world. So here we're talking about the United States and Europe and some other countries as well, and the developing world, and that each of them seems to have a very distinct set of interests, and that those interests seem to be in conflict to the point where they could not work some kind of an agreement out to give everybody something of what they want, and that's what brings us to the point here where things are at least at a deadlock. I don't know if anybody really thinks that means there'll never be any talks again, but now, you know, we've sort of come up to the wall. Is it possible to talk a little bit about, say, you know, put yourself in the perspective of each of these sides, and maybe in fact there are more than just two sides, and talk a little bit about how things, you know, what's important to, say, the United States, and then what would be important to nations like India, for example, that might represent sort of the two poles here?
Right. Well, there's a number. It's more than bipolar. Among the developed countries, as you mentioned, there are somewhat different policies, particularly in agriculture, with the U.S. and the EU, the European Union, having quite a conflict over the high level of subsidies in the European Union, and a number of conflicts within that about exactly what types of policy instruments the United States, the European Union, Japan, other developed countries are using to support and protect their agriculture. So there are those conflicts between the developed countries. Then with the developing countries, it's a very heterogeneous group. There are some developing countries, Argentina comes to mind, but also in Africa, Malawi comes to mind, Zimbabwe comes to mind, Brazil comes to mind, that are natural agricultural exporters and would benefit greatly from improved market access in agricultural products. There are other developing countries that are natural agricultural importers, are somewhat concerned if the trade negotiations lead to higher world prices for agricultural products. There are other developing countries that have protected their own agricultural sectors with high tariffs, for example, who are concerned that if they lower those tariffs, their own farmers will be exposed to more competition. So a very diverse set of interests among the developing countries.
It seems that in maybe this is oversimplifying things, but as I read about when you ask this question, well, why did we come to this impasse? That it seems that it is represented as basically a major conflict, a north-south conflict between developed and developing countries. And the big gripe, it seems, that the developing countries have is the kind of protections that the United States and the EU have for its farmers. That is, they pay them high subsidies, and there are barriers to the import of ag products from the developing world. That's sort of the developing world's gripe. On the other side, the United States and the EU says, well, their complaint is barriers to the stuff that they want to export.
Right.
And in which case, probably would be here, basically manufactured products. And they say, well, the developing countries, they're putting up barriers to us being able to sell in their country the things that we produce and the things that we want. So it seems that each side is saying the other side is the problem because they're putting up barriers to us being able to sell our stuff over on their side.
That's right. And, of course, the basic idea of a trade negotiation is, and it's been well recognized ever since the Great Depression of the 1930s, that if globally trade barriers are reduced, then overall the global income levels, welfare, whatever you want to call it, is improved. But in that process, within individual countries, there are winners and losers. And so it's a very complicated process getting countries to agree just what kinds of changes they'll make as they negotiate an agreement that makes trade more feasible, that lowers trade barriers. There have been a number of these negotiations since World War II. We're in about the ninth round of these negotiations, and they're always difficult. And this one is proving particularly difficult. Agriculture has been really a focus of this one, but it's not the only focal point. For the developed countries, it's like the United States. It's not just they're concerned that countries like Brazil or India and China both reduce their tariffs on manufactured products, which tend to be higher than in the developed world, but also on agricultural products, because agricultural products are an important export product for the United States, and many of these countries have high barriers against our agricultural products as well. Mm-hmm. On the developing country side, they have put a lot of emphasis on access to the agricultural markets in the developed countries, because one of their, you know, for a number of the developing countries, as I've mentioned, one of their the products they really view themselves as having a potential to export if it weren't for the barriers would be the agricultural products.
Well, when you take a look at the complaints that that those people representing the interests of both sides have, and who sort of say, well, you know, the problem is really those guys over there. I mean, everybody yeah. seems to be doing that. Say, well, the problem is those guys over there. Can you actually say that the lack of progress? We can blame the lack of progress. We can sort of lay it out even all around, or is it the case, as some people would say, that one of these sides or the other, some people would say, well, the big problem here is the United States. Yeah. And of course, in the United States, they probably say, well, no. The big problem is, you know, somebody else. Can you really lay out responsibility, or is it more of a case where, yeah, in fact, there are all these competing interests and everybody's trying to get what they want for their constituents, and they don't want to yield very much?
Yeah. Well, we're staying at a pretty high level of generality right now, and that's okay. Let me take it first from the U.S. perspective and then from some other perspectives, because I think that there's plenty of blame to go around, if you will, and if there's a negotiated agreement, there'll be plenty of, well, be two things. One, if there's a negotiated agreement, we'll have to look very carefully at it and see, you know, how substantive it really is. Sometimes politicians walk away claiming great victory, but when you look at the details, there's not much substantive there. And if there is a good substantive agreement, there'll be plenty of credit to be given. So, but right now we're in an impasse, so let's talk about the blame for the impasse, if you will. From the United States perspective, we are concerned, let's focus on agriculture. Illinois is a big agricultural state. I work primarily on agriculture, although we've already mentioned that manufacturing and also access for services like banking and other services are also issues. All these issues are interconnected. But agriculture has been one of the focal points of discussion. So let's focus for a minute on that. In agriculture, from the U.S. perspective, what it wants to gain from this is more access to two types of markets, Europe and Japan, and other highly protected developed country markets where there's high tariff protection for agricultural products, and also developing countries which have had high tariff protection for agricultural products. So that's what the U.S. wants to gain. What other countries are criticizing the U.S. for, and also criticizing the Europeans, but let's focus on the U.S. for a minute, is the high level of our domestic support payments, where we're spending anywhere from $10 to $25 billion a year supporting our farmers, of which there's only 300,000 or 400,000, which are producing something like 80% of the food outputs that we produce. So fairly large subsidies for each farm in the United States. So the outside the United States critics, developing countries, countries like Australia that are fairly wealthy but don't subsidize their agriculture as much, are criticizing the U.S. for its limited ability or willingness so far to reduce its domestic subsidies. I think the U.S. actually has some additional capacity beyond what we've put on the table right now in Geneva to agree to limits on its domestic subsidies. These are caps that we can't exceed. Sometimes we're well below those caps in a particular year anyhow. So we have some room to reduce those more, perhaps, than we've put on the table. So we're being blamed, in a sense, right now for not letting the negotiations move forward. But what we are, in turn, are saying is we can't put any more subsidy cuts on the table unless we see real market access openings occur from Europe in particular, but also from some of the middle-income, wealthier developing countries, which are big potential markets. So that's how the impasse looks. I guess I've sort of covered both sides, because from the developing country point of view, it's the unwillingness of the U.S. to cut its farm subsidies that's making them say we're not willing to open up our own markets unless you cut those subsidies. So you see how they're sort of, everyone's boxed up in criticizing the other one and not being willing to move.
Right. Well, what perspective do you think possibility there is here in the new term, in the near term, that these talks will get going again?
Yeah. I think it's actually, obviously, unless you're one of the really top-level negotiators, you don't know exactly what the sticking points are, aside from in general terms. But even if you're a top-level negotiator, there's probably no one in the world right now who can say with certainty whether these negotiations will pick up at the end of this year, after the election, early next spring, or will collapse until after, say, the U.S. presidential election in 2008. There are people planning strategies for accomplishing either having the round pick up or perhaps having the round not pick up. But no one individual controls it, and I doubt anyone really knows for sure how the way they play their hand will lead to the outcome they're hoping for. So there's a lot of talk about trying yet again to get this round underway within the next, you know, 3 to 4 or 5 months so that some sort of agreement can be reached before the president's authority to take a trade agreement to Congress and have it voted up or down without amendments. What's called the Trade Promotion Authority, which expires in the middle of next year, could still be used to ratify, so to speak, some sort of agreement, or the promotion authority could be extended because everyone could see that an agreement had been reached and was something Congress ought to consider.
Yeah.
But whether that will happen is, I think really no one, those who are planning a strategy to make that happen, can't be sure that strategy will work.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, David Ordon. He's an agricultural economist. He's a senior research fellow in the Markets, Trade, and Institutions Division of the International Food Policy Research Institute. That's based in Washington, D.C. He's also professor of agricultural and applied economics at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. And we're talking about the current round of international trade talks that broke down over basic, very fundamental disagreements just in late July. This is the so-called Doha round, so named because the very first session was held in Qatar, in Doha, Qatar, way back in 2001. And there have been periodic meetings all along in which the parties representing the various interests got together and tried to see if they could hash out some agreement. And so far, it's been very difficult. And as I said, right now, we seem to be at an impasse. The talks were declared officially dead in the water, and there's no telling when they would resume. Questions here are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We do have also a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, or WILO, which probably doesn't make it any easier to get the number, 333-9455, and then toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, this just, I'm sure to a lot of people, this seems kind of frustrating that there doesn't, you know, you wonder, well, what sort of room in here for there to be some give and take in there, in this, is there? There doesn't really seem to be very much. You say, well, for example, on the United States, there maybe is some. We could give some, perhaps, on the issue of farm supports. But on some of these other basic issues, it doesn't really seem that there's a whole lot of room for any of these parties to negotiate.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things you got to keep in mind. First of all, again, as I've said, really ever since World War II, first of all, there was a sort of collective political decision that trade liberalization, trade negotiations were a desirable thing, that the world needed a first rules-based and secondly more liberal, that is less tariffs and other quotas and other trade barriers kind of trade regime. And that's why the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade was established in the planning for the post-World War II era. So that's driven in part, again, by the theory, in part, as I mentioned, by the political realities of the battle with the communist world, in part by the actual technologies and increased communications and globalization. And those forces are driving the world towards more trade. In some ways, the trade negotiations lead that, and in some ways, they follow it. So in a certain sense right now, we're having a trade negotiation. It's proving very difficult. But there's still a sort of underlying feeling that the world needs an updated trade regime and that we're continually needing to update it and improve it, and that will continue to be the case. There's also in the under the WTO, which the World Trade Organization replaced the GATT in 1994 with the completion of the Uruguay round, there is now a much stronger dispute settlement procedure in the WTO. Before the WTO, under the old GATT from World War II to 1994, any country could block a dispute panel ruling by the GATT panel. So if you were the country that was being complained against about one of your trade policies, you could simply say, I don't accept the ruling, and that stopped the process. The WTO reversed that. Now it would take a unanimous vote of the members, including the party that was making the complaint, to overrule a panel ruling. So there's a much stronger legal process, and countries have been using that to resolve trade disputes when they feel the negotiated Uruguay round agreement is being violated. And the U.S. has been party to many of those disputes and won and lost in those legal proceedings. So that puts some pressure again to reach a new negotiated agreement, because if there's no negotiated agreement, people recognize that more use could be made of this dispute settlement mechanism, and it could be a lot of contentious sort of mini trade wars, if you will, over with a somewhat binding legal process for determining them. So there are some pressures that keep pressure on to get an agreement, but it has proven very difficult, and agriculture is one of the reasons it's been so difficult.
Let's talk with a listener here. We have someone calling in from Chicago. Let's go there, line number four. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Thanks a lot. One thing I don't think anybody ever really talks about or takes into consideration is the Europeans aren't really protecting their agriculture. They're protecting their tourist industry. Nobody would want to go to Europe if France and Belgium and all those countries looked like Illinois with Walmarts and no family farms left. No one would go there. And the tourist industry in Europe is the largest industry they've got. That's what they're protecting. We go there because we can still see a farm with a couple cows and some chickens, and, you know, the farmer's still getting by. So that's the Europeans' thing. The stuff of the third world is a total disaster. I mean, Mexico City is the world's largest city with total poverty because we have poured $2 a bushel corn into their country, completely destroyed the means of living for the vast majority of the people that used to live on the land. They've all given up and gone to Mexico City, and of course there's nothing there. So anytime I hear these talks failing, we should applaud it. I mean, this globalization of agriculture is terrible for most people. I mean, do we have expensive food? Food is the cheapest it's ever been in the history of the world. It doesn't need to get cheaper. When poor people in America are using McDonald's as a cafeteria because the food is so cheap, then maybe it's too cheap. When I was a kid, and my parents were not poor. My mother was a teacher. My father was an engineer. You went to McDonald's once a year as a treat. And the reason was, it was expensive. It was much cheaper for my mother to go home and make hamburgers and fries at home, even though we didn't like her fries, because McDonald's was expensive. And this food thing is nuts. We don't need cheaper food. You know, let the food get more expensive. There might be some other things we could argue about, but, I mean, global trade is a disaster for most people in this world.
Well, Professor Orton, what do you think?
Well, again, I mentioned we have this globalization reality. We've had these GATT rounds, and I should have said, of course, because there's these distributional consequences of changes in trade policy and trade occurring even without changes in policy, we do get a lot of adverse reactions as well. And that's why, you know, that's why these negotiations are so difficult. In terms of the European Union, in terms of the caller's specific comments on the European Union, basically what is trying to be negotiated in the trade negotiations is that policies you use to support your agriculture are not production stimulating or consumption depressing, and therefore don't distort trade. So you can do things that keep the landscape beautiful, if you will. You can keep some cows on the landscape if you don't milk them, so to speak. And so the issue is which policies are trade distorting and which policies are not as trade distorting and yet can provide some income to farmers. So certainly tourism is important to Europe, and we want to go see beautiful fields of cows in Switzerland, but we don't want to see those cows being milked and then that milk being sold on the world markets at prices well below the Swiss prices and depressing prices, and then making it very difficult for, say, the dairy industry in India, which is a very poor country and which is the biggest world producer of milk in the world, those prices depressed for farmers in India. That's the idea, to get away from those trade-distorting policies. For the food things, of course, in the United States, we're so fortunate. Food is, as farmers and as consumers, we're fortunate as consumers because the high technology of our agriculture has made food cheap, and we enjoy the benefits of that. We have some health concerns about eating too much and so on, what exactly we eat, they're currently very important. But we're fortunate to have this low-cost food and to have the high incomes to enjoy it. But in a lot of the world, that's not true, and food still remains a substantial part of the family budget for many people in developing countries. So you need to find ways to give them opportunities to sell foods in the world markets. You need to find opportunities for them to not have so much protection of their own. Sounds funny, but you know, not disadvantage their consumers with tariffs. And you need to recognize that not all the world benefits at right now from the same low level of their income spent on food as we do.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. Others are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I get that in a sense gets at the question that at some point I wanted to raise, and that was particularly for people living in the United States, why this really matters. And it seems as if one of the main points of these trade talks, as you said way back at the beginning, was to try to improve conditions for people in the poorer countries of the world and kind of get the tide to raise all the boats.
Right.
You can see how this, you know, how thing, you know, what would benefit, how changes would benefit them. It maybe a little bit more difficult to see exactly why, perhaps why most Americans, unless maybe you're a farmer, would care one way or the other about what goes on in these trade talks, unless, of course, they thought that somehow it would mean that their grocery bill suddenly would go up.
Right. Well, let me give you an example. You know, one of the things we have now that we did not have before, we had the theory and we had the negotiations. Now, since the mid-80s, with the more advanced computer technology we have, we now can create models of the world economy. And, you know, a model of the world economy is a pretty abstract thing, as you can imagine, to reduce the whole world economy to, you know, 30 or 40 countries or regions and 15 or 20 products. But, you know, we do have those kind of economic models to give us empirical numbers. Let me just give you a couple of feel for the results of those kinds of models. First of all, the developed world is about 80% of the world economy. I mean, the list of what we call developed countries are about 80% of the world economy. And so it's not the least developed countries, what are called the LDCs, are only 1% of the total world economy. I mean, these are really small, poor, 50 small, poor countries, very low income per person and very low total income. When you run through these models, what would happen if we got some sort of Doha agreement? Then what you find is that a good portion of those gains go to the countries that are the biggest part of the economy, but that the gains are somewhat progressive. So instead of the developed world getting 80% of the gains because they were initially 80% of the world economy, if we had something like what's being debated as a Doha agreement, they would get something like 50% of the benefits from that, and the other benefits would go to middle-income countries and low-income countries. So there's an overall gain, and it's somewhat progressive, and that seems like a constructive net set of outcomes for a policy change. When we look at something specific, in the Hong Kong meeting in December, the European Union had proposed that the LDCs get free access for all products to the developed country market. So this is just, again, these 50 poorest countries in the world, 1% of the world economy, the very, very poorest countries. The United States wouldn't agree to that. At the Hong Kong meeting, all the United States would agree to is for 97% of the different products, the LDCs would get free access. But it turns out that 3% can block a lot of trade because these poor countries only export a few products. And so when we run through these models, what difference does it make if you get 97% free access versus 100% free access for these 50 poorest countries in the world, the real basket cases of the world? Turns out their gain from a Doha-type agreement would only be about $1 billion a year in total with the 97% access, but with 100% access, they would gain about $7 billion a year. So a small change in the negotiated agreement can make a big difference to specific countries and specific, you know, for specific people.
Well, again, I guess that makes it, for those people who'd say that the problem here is the United States, that sort of makes it look like the United States is the bad guy.
The United States did not look good on this issue of the free access because the European Union have called for this free access, again, for the poorest countries. And the United States resists that because of our sensitivity on textile imports, in particular on textile imports from Bangladesh and a few other least developed countries. So we didn't look like the knight on the white horse when it came to that one specific provision of what should be agreed. And that was bad for our image as the nation that has led the charge, if you will, you know, for more integration of the world economy, for more reduction of trade barriers as a way of making a stronger world economy, as a way of defeating the communist regimes, as a way of now integrating some of the poorest countries in the world so that, you know, we don't get a sort of split between the poor and disenfranchised and the wealthy and enfranchised. So we didn't look good on that particular provision. There are many other provisions where the United States is arguing for points of the agreement that would be beneficial for poor countries, and others are arguing against them.
Well, you talked about a little earlier about the fact that you have to look at the U.S. perspective and, in a sense, break it down, because the issues there are issues involving the United States and other developed countries. So issues involving trade between the United States and Europe and Japan, say. And then there are also maybe a slightly different set of issues that has to do with the trade relations between the United States and developing countries. If you break those, and you talked about how we were talking and have been talking about this on a pretty general sort of level. I mean, if you break that out between the two groups, the developed countries on the one hand and the developing countries on the other, where are the more difficult set of issues? And if we could somehow separate them.
Right. They're difficult on all sides, David, unfortunately. If you just, you could say, why don't we just get a trade agreement? Well, let's get Japan, the European Union, Australia, the United States, you know, a few other countries, maybe the OECD wealthy countries, to agree to some sort of trade agreement. In fact, the WTO is a little bit like that, because the middle income countries are always asked to do a little less tariff reduction and to take a little more time to do it than the developed countries. It's called special and differential treatment. So you could say, well, let's just get an agreement among the developed countries. And that would be very difficult because of the EU-US disputes over particularly agricultural trade. The US and the EU and Japan and Australia already have pretty low tariffs on manufactured products. Their main disagreement is on the relatively high tariffs in agriculture, a little bit in textiles and apparel. So it would be difficult, even if you just forgot about the rest of the world, to get an agreement on agriculture between the developed countries, between those who are protecting their agriculture and those who are more natural agricultural exporters and want access to those markets. If you go to the developing countries, you almost have the same thing. Again, you have the Malawis and the Brazils and the Uruguays that are natural agricultural exporters, and they see growth potential in trade with their southern partners, but many of those southern partners are protecting their own agriculture. And so you almost have the same divide among the developing countries as you have among the developed. Mm. And then going cross between them, similar kinds of natural sort of common sense aspirations. The developed countries that are agricultural exporters would like to see more access to the Chinas and the Indias, where they see big populations and rising income levels and prospective demand, you know, substantial increased demand for food. So at either across the heights of income or within the heights of income, you get these complexities and difficulties negotiating. And so you have to find ways to show many countries that they're going to be gaining in something that's important to them. And so far, we just haven't found that formula for this round.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, David Ordon. He is a senior research fellow in the Markets, Trade, and Institutions Division of the International Food Policy Research Institute in Washington. He's also professor of agricultural and applied economics at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. And we're talking about international trade talks, particularly the collapse of the recent round of talks, the so-called Doha round, that began back in 2001 and have been continuing since, but wrestling without apparently a lot of progress over some fundamental and difficult issues. The talks broke down in late July, and there is some question about, maybe not question about if they ever will resume again, but question about when. And questions here on the program are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and we have about 15 minutes in this hour of the show. It is the case that while the United States and the countries of Europe and Japan are industrialized countries, it is the case that within those countries, their farmers, their farm sectors have a lot of political power, not exactly in proportion to their numbers. Is it fair to say, and I'll probably get myself in trouble here if we have any farmers listening, is it fair to say, as some people would suggest, that sector has too much influence on trade policy in those countries?
It's certainly fair to say that agriculture has been largely left out of the move to lower tariffs that's occurred over the last 40 or 50 years among the developed countries in particular on industrial products. That is a true statement. Agriculture tariffs are still averaging something to 17 to 20%. Industrial tariffs among the developed countries of the world are down around 4%, 3 or 4%. So you can see a higher level of protection among the developed countries in agriculture than is in manufacturing, and much less reduction over time. And so that would be an indication of the political influence of the farm groups within each country in holding the protection of their own domestic production.
It is, I suppose, there in their defense, they would say, well, it's not like other businesses, that it has a level of volatility and uncertainty that other manufacturing concerns just don't have. And
right.
So that for that reason, it's important that farmers be given that kind of protection, simply because they really don't know what they're going to have to deal with from one year to the next.
Yeah. Well, those issues come up, those kinds of arguments come up frequently, including in the U.S. debate. And agriculture is different in some ways. Historically, it's employed large parts of the population, but now in industrial countries, that's down to a very small, as I said, 300,000 or 400,000 farmers produce about 80% of the food product, of the agricultural products that we produce in the United States by value. So it's come from millions of people living on the land and making their living off the land to a fairly small group of people making their living off the land. Of course, many people involved in the food sector, retailing and wholesaling and so on. Agriculture is different in the sense that, it is the land. These are the people who are, so to speak, stewards of our land, and the country is partly defined by its land, right? So it does have some unique characteristics, but you can overstate those, especially in a world where the commercial farming sector is quite commercial, and there may be a small farmer or a part-time farmer sector, that, as we have in the United States, quite different. A lot of people farming because they are able to combine working on their farm with working off their farm to a sort of mixed income, often with a large part of their income coming actually from off the farm, but still keeping the rural lifestyle and contributing a small amount to our total agricultural output. So there are some differences, but you again can overstate those in terms of being a rationale for countries, each country protecting its own agricultural sector.
I mentioned several times your affiliation with the International Food Policy Research Institute, and the stated mission of the Institute, reading off of what it says on the website, is to provide policy solutions that cut hunger and malnutrition.
Right.
And now we've talked about the fact that here in the United States, and I don't want to underplay the idea that there are, in fact, hungry people in the United States, but also there, as you have pointed out quite rightly, there are a lot of Americans for whom the issue is not that they don't get enough to eat, but that maybe that they eat too much. Having said that, let's look at particularly at the developing world. And is there, in fact, a way in which the kinds of issues that we're talking about here does have something to do with whether people are getting enough to eat there? And
right.
does it affect what daily life is like for people in those countries?
Yeah. Well, IFPRI, the International Food Policy Research Institute, is part of a set of 15 international centers that were set up in the 1970s with the large support from the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation and support from the World Bank to provide, if you will, a college of agriculture like Champaign-Urbana's University of Illinois, basically a college of agriculture for the developing countries. IFPRI is the only one of the centers that's focused on the social sciences, economics in particular, but other aspects, governance and so on as well, and nutrition and areas like that, policy areas like that. But other centers are focused on, for example, rice breeding or dry land agriculture or maize. The most famous of these centers, in a way, is CIMMYT, the center in Mexico where the Norman Borlaug developed the miracle wheat, which has transformed wheat production in the 1970s in the Punjab area of India and Pakistan, and substantially raised their food production by using more modern techniques. It was somewhat criticized for making the farmers more dependent on modern fertilizers and pesticides, but it just so dramatically increased their food production that Norm Borlaug's a huge hero in that part of the world. So that's what these centers are here for. The trade negotiations are one avenue to give countries an opportunity to earn more income in the world market. But if you think about it, you can only earn more income if you have a trade opportunity, if you have the capacity to actually increase your supply and produce for that market. And a large part of IFPRI's work and this set of centers' work is focused on, in fact, helping these countries improve the supply of their agricultural products, the marketing of their agricultural products, the research into new technologies and the extension of those new technologies to farmers, how do you get markets to work well so that farmers can actually get connected to first their local towns and then their bigger cities and then the international market. That's really the overall objective of this set of the 15 centers. And trade plays an important role, but it's not a panacea. The amount of income gains you get from something like what might be negotiated in Doha are important to the world, but they don't make the poor countries suddenly rich. They only open some opportunities, then you need all of those other things to make a country become more wealthy.
As you mentioned a little bit earlier there, and we talked about the fact that these talks now have been going on for some time, that there's an impasse now. They're sort of dead in the water, at least for the moment, and there's some question about when things might get going again. One important deadline is the middle of next year, when the fast-track authority that had been granted to the White House by the Congress is going to expire. So that would make it more difficult after that point for the president to negotiate a trade deal. It's not impossible, but it would involve greater involvement by the Congress, and that might make things more difficult. And you said that, in fact, it could well be that things really won't get going again. We might, in fact, end up waiting until there's another presidential administration, till after the next election, to seriously get back to this. I think that some people maybe raise some questions about if there is a long-standing impasse, and if this is just left kind of to go, that it in fact raises some questions about the future of the World Trade Organization, and that if we can't come up with some agreement on this, then the WTO loses one of its reasons to exist. That this is, you know, the failure of these nations to come to grips with this issue really undercuts the purpose of the organization. Do you think that is true?
Well, that can be overstated, but there is a little bit of the Bob Dylan feeling of, you know, he not busy being born, he's busy dying. If you're not progressing towards a next step, you know, we're far, far from total free trade in the world. Industrial tariffs are low for the developed world. They're higher for the developing world. Agricultural tariffs are high in many, many countries. So there's many steps. There's a whole areas of services that have not been well dealt with in terms of, will laborers from or professional people from, say, in India be able to come to the United States and work on a temporary basis? Will U.S. banks be able to open branches in other countries? All sorts of services, which is a growing part of the economy, that the world doesn't have very good rules about how that part of the world economy is going to operate. There's the potential for breakdown into all sorts of little regional trading agreements and conflict between those that are actually detrimental to the world economy. So there's a lot of risks in not moving forward and a sense of progress, and there's mostly been a sense of progress. The Uruguay Round ended in 1994. There was a six-year implementation period for the developed countries, 10 years for the developing countries, and new negotiations in services and in agriculture were built into the Uruguay Round actually for 6 years later, actually started in the year 2000. Those were subsumed then into the Doha Round when it was launched more broadly in basically 2 years later. So there is a need, in a certain sense, to have some negotiations underway and some progress being made, and a lull of 3 or 4 years now could be very detrimental in that sense. So there's, in that sense, an optimistic scenario would be that something get worked out to where some sort of framework agreement is put before Congress before next July or next June when the fast track expires, so that fast track could be reauthorize for consideration of that agreement. That would be the optimistic scenario. The pessimistic scenario is that doesn't happen. If any kind of restart of the negotiations put off let's say, well into a next presidential administration. That leaves a 3 or 4 year period where there's no negotiations going on. The WTO would continue to function. The Uruguay round rules stay in place. The dispute settlement mechanism I mentioned would be increasingly used by countries and would lead to more panels and more panel rulings and more of that kind of activity. But it would undermine one of the fundamental pillars of the WTO, which is to progressively, year after year, decade after decade, help the world move to modernized, rules-based, and liberalized trade. That's its objective.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, I'm interested, and we talked, sort of touched on this earlier, that perhaps one of the complaints or one of the concerns of the United States about the whole WTO regime was this mechanism for dealing with disputes, and that the United States was concerned that maybe that the United States wouldn't get a fair hearing. I think some people have said, well, it's a good thing to have a kind of place you can work these disputes out and have the have it have some teeth, you know, have it actually able to do something. And the United States, I think, was very hesitant. They didn't like the idea that they might that the ruling would go against them. And when you look at these kinds of disputes and the kinds of complaints, particularly that have either that have been brought against the United States, that have been brought by the United States in this framework, whether you can say have things often gone against our interest? Have we gotten what we want? Do we get some of each? So you have to say, well, it has sort of been a mix of good and bad for the United States.
Well, like any judicial process, it has been a mix of winning cases and losing cases for the United States. I can't give you the numbers off the top of my head, but certainly across all areas of disputes, I think the process is we've won lots of cases and we've been ruled against in a number of cases. So in that sense, that's the way you'd expect a good judicial process to work, given that there is no country that is the white knight on a white horse charging around in purity on international trade, but rather each country kind of pursuing its own interests with quirks of how policy is developed in its own political process and legitimate complaints by its trade partners. I don't want to overstate the level of these disputes because given the volume of world trade, I mean, like any judicial process, they serve a useful role because they're there. They can be used for most egregious claims of not living up to the rules. The fact that you can do that leads a number of cases to be settled without a formal dispute, and our U.S. Trade Representative's office will have every year an annual report on types of disputes the U.S. has been involved in that are not necessarily formal WTO disputes and how they've been resolved. And so countries have that process has been pushed forward by this change in ruling from a very weak, what lawyers call soft law, to a slightly stronger law. But the WTO has no police force. It cannot force a government to do anything. If you don't like a ruling against you, the worst that can happen is the country that won the case against you is allowed to put some retaliatory tariffs on because you didn't change your policy, which was found in violation of the WTO rules. That's a legal outcome. It's not a very good outcome for trade because then you have the original policies that were in violation of the rule, found in violation of the rules, and then the compensation, if you don't change those policies, the other country can retaliate against you. So you end up with two types of trade barriers. So you try to avoid that and try to work out a change in law, as the U.S. has done, as the U.S. has led other countries to do, when you can, so that you're not out of compliance. But sometimes you get just a logjam, and that's what happens. Mm-hmm. So WTO is only so strong in imposing law. International law is relatively weak compared to national law. I was teaching class one day, and two police officers came to the – it only happened once in 20 years. Two police officers came to my door, asked me to step out of class. They were there trying to arrest someone in the class. Well, the WTO has no police like that who are going to come to a country, arrest its leaders because they violated WTO law.
Yeah. That must have been an odd and interesting experience.
It was an interesting experience. Like I say, fortunately, it's only happened once in 20 years. I'm happy to report that.
Did you ask them to wait until after the class was finished?
Actually, the student wasn't there.
Oh.
But they were there looking for him, that was for sure.
Is it we're down to the point here where we almost have to finish. And I guess, and maybe this would be difficult in a short amount of time, but when we talk about the kind of disputes that have gone to mediation here at the WTO, what exactly are we talking about?
Well, they're across all subjects. I mean, they can be in this area of technical barriers to trade, where we claim, say, a technical barrier isn't based on good science like it's supposed to be, and that there's no risk, and it's really just a barrier put up by a country under a false claim of a risk. We've won a case against the European Union on their objection to our cattle who are raised with a little clip of growth hormones in their ear. The European Union has lost that case but refused to change its policy. As I mentioned, sometimes you get into that situation. There have been disputes on farm policies. The Brazilians won a case against us that our cotton support policies violated WTO rules, and that case is still being – U.S. changes in U.S. cotton policy are still being made according to the ruling in that case. There have been lots of cases outside of agriculture having to do with, you know, industrial products. So the dispute mechanism can be applied to any part of the WTO. And again, the U.S. has been both a successful complainant and also been subject to some of its policies being ruled out of compliance with the WTO, and had to either adjust those policies or reach some sort of compensation or face some sort of penalty in terms of its own access to other markets.
Well, we're here at the end of our time, and we're going to have to leave it there. If people are interested in finding out more about the International Food Policy Research Institute, at which our guest David Orden is a senior research fellow, they do have a website. It's www.ifpri.org, so you can go there. David Orden is a professor of agricultural and applied economics at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. And Professor Orden, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, David.